Hello, I'm Paul Yeager. In this episode of the M2M podcast, we're going to go on a trade mission. Let's let the West Wing set it up here.
He'll be attacked during the debate on China. He'll have to defend his trade goals versus human rights violations.
Trade's essential for human rights. Instead of isolating him, we make him live by the same global trading rules as everyone else and gain 1.2 billion consumers for our products and strengthen the forces of reform.
That's it. It's that simple.
No, it's not simple. It's incredibly complicated.
Global trade is hard to understand and is extremely complicated, and it cannot be boiled down to a simple phrase. But we're going to try. This episode of the podcast, which is a production of Iowa Public Television and the Market to Market Television Show, is going to cover trade. We are going to go global, national, and local with Steve Noah. And Steve is on the board of directors for the Farmers for Free Trade. Maybe you've seen their bus travel to your town, your state. They went across the country in 2019 talking about the issue of trade. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to eventually get into the discussions about what happens if no trade deals with USMCA are completed. We'll talk about China. We'll talk about other countries where American products and maybe what's the value in a trade deal. And maybe what's the value in just growing and keeping and not importing or exporting anything for use. But as Steve says, you might want to refresh yourself on how to can. We'll explain in this episode, which we have broken into two parts. So the first one, we're going to discuss some of his background. We're going to, you know me, go on a tangent and talk about the weather and a very big storm that hit his hometown back more than 50 years ago. And then eventually we will discuss his life as a realtor, as a banker, a politician, international trade consultant, his consultant work, his lobbyist work. And, oh, by the way, a little nugget that I learned after the fact, Steve Noah was a state wrestling champ. We'll talk about that in this edition of the M2M podcast. So when you came to Iowa in 1986, was that your first experience with Iowa?
No, actually, I was born in Iowa.
You were born in Iowa.
In 1948.
And where?
Charles City, Iowa.
Charles City. Why is it that there's two towns I found in my time in this state that everybody has a connection to? It's either Grundy Center or Charles City.
Well, those of us that were born and raised in Charles City in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s believe that Charles City is the center of Western civilization.
And it is America's hometown.
It is America's hometown,
as
yes.
The sign goes. It's in the northeast part of the state. And you were there. How old were you in 1968?
In 1968, I was a sophomore in college. And so I was in Iowa City when the terrible tornado hit Charles City.
Yeah.
Ironically, around noon of the May 15th, 1968, we had a hailstorm in Iowa City that was perhaps the worst hailstorm they had ever had. Thousands and thousands of panes of glass were broken in the hailstorm. And my roommate at the time, Bob Shriver, had a car that was terribly damaged in the hailstorm. And we called my father, who was an attorney in Charles City, and asked him to call an insurance adjuster in Charles City because all the insurance adjusters in Iowa City were busy.
Yeah.
And Dad said, we're having a beautiful day in Charles City.
Oh.
And at 5 o'clock, the town blew away.
Yeah. And so those that don't know, yeah, 1968, Charles City had a tornado of all tornadoes, and it made a very big impact on a couple of communities. Charles City was one. Olwine was another. More people probably should have died if it wasn't for radio communication and people listening to the advice of this is a very serious storm coming. I know, Steve, you and I have sat in meetings with another group, and we've heard audio from that day of warning people. And had you heard the story about the guy in Olwine who had been out at the tower warning people, you know, he called back into town or the station, and that saved more people in Olwine.
Yes, that's correct. The tornado in Charles City was actually two tornadoes that joined over the river. And one of the real ironies and blessings of the tornado is it came in from the south. It jumped over the hospital and then was on the ground continually for about 4 miles. and it destroyed about $35 million worth of damage. It destroyed, I believe, 14 churches and schools. It went right down Main Street, and it is just amazing that more people did not lose their lives. I believe 15 people were killed in the tornado.
And it was that was a big change for Charles City. Charles City at that time was a large manufacturing, had a tractor manufacturing in town, and it came back, but it did alter the landscape of that community.
Oh, it did. Charles City was a town of approximately 13,000, give or take. And we were a very white-collar town. We had the management and the experiment of white farm equipment, formerly the Oliver Corporation and formerly Hart Parr. And we like to say that the farm tractor was invented in Charles City because Hart Parr's patented name for their agricultural machine was the tractor. And so if the tractor itself was not invented there, the term tractor was invented there. We were the home of Salisbury's Laboratories, which was the world's largest producer of poultry pharmaceuticals. We were the home of the George P. Smith Company that blew away and was never replaced. A couple thousand jobs, one of the largest millwork companies in the United States. And we lost probably 3,000 jobs in a town of 13,000 that never came back after the tornado. Kind of like today, there was some huge political divides in the town, and we had a very aggressive urban renewal plan that was being promoted in 1968, and we had an anti-urban renewal, anti-federal money group of people that were elected to the city council. And so the tornado came through, and they were elected on the platform of accepting no federal money in Charles City because we didn't want to be feeding at the federal trough. So the tornado came through Charles City. Things were destroyed. We didn't know what to do. The city council held firm to their no federal money. And from 68 to 70 until there was another municipal election, we really didn't get a lot of federal aid to rebuild the town. And so we lost 2 years in that time. Well, we did clean some things up, but a lot of the infrastructure was not repaired from the tornado because we had this group of city fathers that had pledged not to accept federal dollars.
All right. You have the advantage of looking back at history. Was that the right decision by that group?
I did not think so. My parents, and of course I was 20 years old in 1968.
Very idealistic though at that time, Steve.
Oh, very idealistic. But I thought that I was firmly behind the pro-urban renewal group. I think that Charles City would have made some huge strides. Had we accepted the federal money, I believe we would have been much better off after the tornado. But, it was what it was.
Yeah. And when I started asking about 1986, when you came to Iowa, you came to run the Republican Party of Iowa.
That's correct.
And so this isn't some big Democrat from the late 60s. You're coming at it from a conservative fiscal, the traditional platform of the party at the time, still the party at the time. What are the parallels to then to now about cities and communities either after a disaster accepting federal aid or just accepting federal government's role in their lives?
That's a very, very difficult question, Paul, because the federal government and the state and city governments have changed so, so very much. We were much more independent as a state and communities, but we were much more willing to dig into our own state pockets to support things. You have to realize that today the argument has been made that across the nation, public universities are being funded at 1960s levels. And we wonder why it's so expensive for our children to go to college. It's because the taxpayer is funding them at the levels of 50, 60 years ago. And the difference has to be made up, and the only place they can really make that up is through donations or through tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a group, as a community in Iowa, and I think all over the United States, but specifically in Iowa, we cared much more about our fellow Iowan and our fellow person in the community than we do now. We are not a caring society in the United States, in my estimation, at the present time.
And you travel around quite a bit around the country and the world.
The world. In fact, I have been in a month's time this year, I've been in four continents. I've been to Rwanda in East Africa 32 times in the last 10 years. I have worked professionally in 15 countries. And so, yes, I believe that's one of the – when we talk about making America great, and I don't want to go down that road at all, but one of the things we have to do is worry about our fellow Iowan, our fellow American, regardless of race, creed, national origin, ethnicity. We don't do that in this country right now, in my estimation.
Well, but that was, I think, part of the appeal of the president was making America great. Because I think there were some that were tired of helping the other countries of the world and didn't feel that we were doing things for this country. I think that rings true a little bit to what you're saying, what the voters and supporters of the president.
And that's a fallacy. That's a fallacy because people think we give a huge amount of non-military foreign aid to the developing world. Our entire U.S. non-military foreign aid budget plus the State Department budget combined is about 1.4% of our national budget. As Senator Harkin would say, it's pencil dust. What we do is give huge amounts of military foreign aid to foreign governments so they can come back and buy weapons from the United States. But our non-military foreign aid from the United States to the developing world, based on GDP, we rank 35th out of 35 developed countries as a percentage of our GDP. So the idea that we're giving huge amounts of money is as a percentage of our federal budget is not true.
And that is – it's hard to delineate who's telling you the truth about stats and facts when it comes to government spending and things like that. How do you sort through it all?
Well, I used to be much better than I am now, and I'll tell you why. We have not passed a federal budget in this country since 2007. Was the last time.
It's the continuing resolution.
All we've done is continuing resolutions. And because of that, we're funding programs now that were included in the 2007 budgets that we perhaps don't need to fund or have run their course or whatever. But because they keep getting funded and funded and funded, we're giving more money to the administration. The other thing that I find quite interesting. And understand that I have done some stuff professionally as what we would call a lobbyist. But all of a sudden, about 7 or 8 years ago, maybe a little longer ago than that, people got upset about the idea of congressionally directed funding, earmarked appropriations. Mm-hmm. The Constitution of the United States says that all spending bills will come from the Congress of the United States. An earmarked appropriation is the Congress directing the administration where that money will go. When you don't earmark, when you just give funding to a department based on their budget requests, the Congress is totally ignoring their mandate by the Constitution to decide where the money is going, and we're giving all the money to the administration. That administration could be George Bush, it could be Barack Obama, it mm-hmm. could be Donald Trump. But we're saying, the Congress is saying, okay, Mr. President, we don't care where you spend our money. And so what the presidents will do, or the administrations will do, because they're political animals, they will give more funding to those states where they have support.
Sure.
And so we get, if we are a democracy, and we're not a true democracy, we're a constitutional republic. But the state of Iowa suffers without earmarks, because when we had our appropriators fighting for Iowa's interests, we could get a little more money. But now the money is decided, that where the money is spent is decided entirely by the administration, whomever is in the administration.
And whoever they appoint to head those agencies, acting or non-acting secretaries. We have so many mm-hmm. interims right mm-hmm. now. We don't have somebody that's congressionally Senate approved or confirmed, how many acting ones we have. So it is absolutely the pleasure of the president.
That's correct. And if the president has to, or if any politician has to make a decision, am I going to give $15 million to Iowa State University or the University of Iowa to do research that they could do the best of anybody in the world, but they have 6 electoral votes? Or am I going to give the same $15 million to Michigan or to mm-hmm. Minnesota or to Wisconsin or to Pennsylvania, even though the research for this particular thing will be not as good. They don't have the best brains, but they have 25 electoral votes. Where am I going to give the money?
Sure.
So I believe that every appropriation should be an earmarked appropriation.
But how would you ever turn the campaign? Because you can remember how the campaigns were. I am against these earmarks for these pet projects, the bridge to nowhere, the, you know, whatever. How are you going to run against that as a candidate? Put your political consultant hat back on, Steve. How do you consult someone to explain that at the AmVets Hall?
That's one of the failings of the, I believe, the system of education in the last 20, 25 years in the United States. We have so many high schools that no longer require a civics course. We have so many high school or colleges that no longer require a true history course or a true government course. For goodness gracious, at the University of Iowa, I've been told you can fulfill a history requirement with a course on the history of the Beatles.
The band, not the bug.
The band, not the bug. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm sure that there are many, many similar types of courses that will require some sort of history component. Mm-hmm. We have to educate our voters. One of the things about our form of government is that it is hard. It takes an educated and intelligent populace, and it takes a participating populace. And right now, I'm not going to say anyone is not intelligent because I think everybody is relatively intelligent, but we're not educated. And we have chosen for whatever reason not to be educated.
Well, how do you score that on a test? How do you rate that on a test? That's what we've become mm-hmm. is standardized scores. I can say we're up 6% over last year. Mm-hmm. Or how do I grade your smarts versus your intelligence.
That's right, and you can't do it on a standardized test, and we become victims of standardized tests.
And you've seen the arguments just as much as I have with people. Right now, you talked a little bit about college and, you know, it's expensive. There was a time when if you weren't going to college, you were considered a loser. Flat out, that's what the people who didn't go to college felt like. Now, you're getting to a point where, oh, maybe that wasn't such a good label or a good process. Mm-hmm. We need plumbers, pipe fitters, mechanics, welders to make our economy thrive, because someone with an English history degree or an English literature degree is probably not always the best one to fix their faucet.
That's true. I consult to Cooter Incorporated, which is a company in Adele that is the world's oldest, best and only evidence-based career guidance company. And I've consulted with them in Africa and other places around the world. The head of their faculty is the dean of the School of Education at the College of William & Mary, Dr. Spencer Niles. And I just spent 3 weeks in Rwanda with Skip Niles and 12 students from the College of William & Mary. Mm-hmm. And Skip Niles will tell you this, that if you have two children and one child becomes a neurosurgeon and the other child becomes a master plumber, at the end of their 65th year, the master plumber will have earned almost twice as much money as the neurosurgeon. And that's just a mind-boggling fact. But I believe it.
Yeah. And that is something that is changing. Where you and I usually see each other is in Waverly. At the Archives of Iowa Broadcasting. I guess I should give some disclosure. Steve and I are both on the Archives of Iowa Broadcasting Board. We discuss broadcasting more than we discuss this, but some of this usually comes up. I have a friend who she graduated from Waverly High School in the late 80s, early 90s timeframe. Let's go to that era so I can be specific. She said students were given – this is a college town. This is a town with a college mm-hmm. similar to Charles City, about 10 to 15,000 people, near a metro area, heavy farm, heavy industry – or manufacturing and some industrial. There's two guidance counselors. Steve, are you going to be the one? Are you interested in a four-year school, or are you interested in working right now to make money at Nestle or, at the time, Terex? And they would assign you which counselor that you worked for. If you went the route of the non-four-year school, they said, all right, here are the three applications. John Deere is hiring, Terex is hiring, and so is Nestle. Which one would you like to go work at? She said that there are people that she went to high school with that took the right as opposed to the left. They're already ready to retire. Mm-hmm. So she goes, well, who is the smart one now? Absolutely. If you're not cut out for college, why go? I have a good friend who I grew up with who's been lamenting on Twitter the last few months about We don't need a bunch of college-educated people. We need more people like me that work with the sod and work with the landscaping and the conservation. And I said, absolutely. But I'm not cut out to do that. I might be cut out for something else. So if you're – there shouldn't be a stigma for whatever the job is. And how does that go away? How's that – or has it gone away?
Well, when you talk about this last presidential election, that's one of the reasons I believe that the president was elected is because of that stigma and because what people call the coastal elites, the East Coast and the West Coast coastal elites, and the way they look down on not only people that don't have an education, but you and I, graduates of Wartburg College, would not be considered educated by the coastal elites that attended Stanford, USC, UCLA,
Harvard, and Yale,
and Princeton. So there is that stigma, and that's something as humans. And I think that if we had more humanities teaching in the high schools, if we had more civics training in the high schools, that would start to go away. That did not always exist. My wife's parents were not college educated, wanted their kids to get a college degree because they thought they could be better at whatever they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that if we have a broad background in what's now called with some scorn the liberal arts, if everybody had a broad background in the humanities, whether in high school or college or a two-year college, the world would be a better place.
Yeah.
But we have morphed away from that for whatever reason.
The world is a complicated place.
The world is a complicated place, and the world's a really, really small place.
It is. And when you find complications, I think we should probably get to what I told you we were going to talk about. Amazing what happens when I go on a tangent. Trade is one of those things, Steve, that's very complicated. I don't know. I sometimes reference a clip from The West Wing years ago when President Bartlet was going on a trip. I can't remember if it was the re-election or if it was just a trade speech. They found an old they called him. He's a kook, right? Albie Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
They brought him in, and he goes, I just need something about global trade. Oh, global trade's really hard to understand, CJ. And, you know, and he comes up with a phrase, an 8-word phrase, basically. And it's just that simple. He goes, it's not just that simple. Global trade is extremely complicated. All right, so I'm going to ask you, how do you boil down trade into 8 words?
In the modern world, the consumer, you and I, have demanded a broader range of food and fiber. The only way we can get that food and fiber that we have demanded on a consistent basis every month of every year is to have trade where we import some of the food and fiber that we need in seasons that we can't grow it here and export our excess food and fiber. And I use food and fiber because those are the two things that we absolutely, absolutely need to exist. And you and I demand fresh fruits and vegetables every month. When I moved to Des Moines in 1986, that was not possible. When I grew up in Charles City, Iowa, if we wanted fruits and vegetables over the winter, my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, my great aunt got together in the kitchen of our house and canned corn, canned tomatoes, canned beans. And this is in the 50s and early 60s. We're not willing to do that now, so we have to have trade so we can import those things that we have. And we export our excesses.
For a financial gain.
And it helps other countries grow. I first got really heavily involved in trade when Dr. Stanley Johnson at Iowa State University and Dr. Michael Reagan at the Greater Des Moines Chamber of Commerce, hired me to run the MATRIC program in the Corporation for International Trade. MATRIC was a federally funded program called the Midwest Agriculture Trade Information Center, and Iowa State used a lot of that money to do research about markets for production from 11 Midwestern states. And Iowa State and Des Moines Chamber jointly started the Corporation for International Trade, which was designed to sell the agricultural products of 11 Midwestern states. And the company was for profit. The first things we did with profit was make the match at Iowa State, and then the profits went, I believe it was 70% to to Iowa State and 20-30% to the chamber. But that's when I first learned about trade. And we had offices that I helped open in 1991 in Mexico City and in Moscow in the Soviet Union. And we did a little work in Hungary as well. And because of a connection I had with former President George H.W. Bush going back to 1986, and because I was interested in agriculture, I played a small but I think fairly significant role in helping advocate for the NAFTA in Mexico and in the United States in 1992, working with Carlos Salinas, the president of Mexico, and George H.W. Bush, the president of the United States. And then later in 1993, after President Bush was defeated, I was invited to serve on a panel discussion about the NAFTA at the first international meeting of the former American Council for Economic Development, then the North American Council for Economic Development in Quebec, and met Brian Mulroney and did a little bit in Canada. What people forget when they look at the NAFTA is that the NAFTA was negotiated and signed by George H.W. Bush, and it was ratified by Bill Clinton.
But it's always Bill Clinton that we see usually in the video that say it was under him.
But it was signed and negotiated by George H.W. Bush. I hope this doesn't happen, but a similar – because I think we need the USMAC signed right now or ratified right now. But it would be if President Trump ratified or negotiated the USMAC, and heaven forbid it doesn't happen, but it doesn't get ratified until 2021 and another president is elected and would sign it or would get it ratified. But it would always be Donald Trump's treaty. The NAFTA was always George H.W. Bush's treaty.
And so it's funny, many, many points that you brought up that I want to follow up on. One is just the naming, because the president calls it USMCA. In Canada, they call it they have a different name for it. And in Mexico, they have a different name. So it's everybody's trying to brand it in their own way, because I think in the biggest thing that you just said there, everybody wants to be a winner in trade.
Mm-hmm.
But then we hear about the losers in trade, and then therefore that's why we don't proceed. But it sounds like in your definition, Steve, there's more winners in trade than there are losers.
They're right, and I don't think there are that many losers. Frankly, let me finish what I was going to say. In 1993, Mexico was still looked at as a developing nation. Today, Mexico is a member of the G20. Mexico, depending on the phase of the moon, is either the 13th or 14th largest economy in the world. Mexico, Canada, and the United States together dwarf the EU, dwarf China in GDP. And that's why this North American Union is so important.
And that's why it was started. But I know people that will tell me to this day, NAFTA was not good for them in their role as a tool and die maker or in a small manufacturing, that my business, I lost my job to Mexico.
There is some truth to that. And this has nothing to do about agriculture or tariffs as we were going to speak today.
Mm-hmm.
But let me tell you why. When the U.S. signed the NAFTA, we had one free trade agreement, and that was the NAFTA. Mexico at that time had about 35. They now have about 88. A reason that our manufacturing left the United States to Mexico had really nothing to do with labor cost. What it had to do was tariffs. Because prior to the NAFTA, a tariff on a car manufacturer in the U.S. was 45%. After the NAFTA, there was no tariff. Today, Volkswagen, within the last 18 months, talked about why they were building a new plant in Mexico rather than another plant in the United States. And they said that the plant they built in Mexico, they would save about $450 total labor cost per unit. But they would sell about $4,500 in tariff cost when they sold that car into other countries, where Mexico had a free trade agreement and the United States did not. And we lost many, many, many manufacturing jobs to Mexico, not because of wages, partially because of manufacturing safety laws, OSHA, but only partially, but primarily because it was of the amount of money would be saved on tariffs selling to other markets. We have to look, Paul, realistically, in the United States, we're about 5% of the world's population. You know, you and I have won a 1 in 20 lottery just by being born in this country. We have 5% of the world's population, and we still have close to half the world's manufacturing capability, maybe 60% of the world's food growing capacity. We can't consume
everything that we do.
So we have to have export markets. And to have export markets just to generate the cash for people to buy, we have to import some stuff as well.
That's part of the deal.
That's part of the deal.
It's not necessarily out of a need because, I mean, you look at certain deals, you're like, why are we importing pork loins to this country when we have hog confinements at the blink of every eye driving through rural Iowa?
Well, not only that, but one of the things I happen to like, ribs. And most of the ribs that we consume in the United States are from Denmark, our EU ribs.
And why? So explain to people why that has to be.
Well, part of it is the way we cut our meat in the United States to meet our needs. We don't have enough ribs. The way the Europeans cut, they have more ribs. They like more pork bellies than we do and so forth. One of the real interesting things that I ran into when I was working in trade was trying to find in the United States, Nebraska Iowa Beef Pack in Nebraska started doing boxed beef. And what that eliminated was all the hanging beef that we used to – beef halves, beef quarters that we used to export. We tried to get markets in Russia. We tried to get markets in Mexico. We tried to get markets in Europe for our beef. They didn't like the cuts that were available in the boxed beef that was really an act of genius by the meatpacking industry in the United States because they got the cuts that were most – looked after for in the United States at a lower price. But what it did is it eliminated the ability to sell the cuts that the Europeans, that the Russians and the Chinese wanted because they needed the hanging beef.
There's always little stories like that.
There are.
All that. And then we have to find new markets that will take the hanging beef.
Or the boxed beef.
Or the boxed beef.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so it's trade is, as you said, there is nothing easy about trade.
When you say finding new markets, that brings me to a point that someone had said it takes years and time to develop some of these markets, find these new opportunities, find these other things. We could be years, maybe even a decade. And then it seems that a lot of that work was basically undone in a matter of months. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely. And this is the reason. Governments create tariffs, but governments don't buy commodities. Governments don't buy cars. Governments don't buy pharmaceuticals. Private entities, some of them partially government-owned, but even in China, who has been the number one market for our soybeans for years, they're not purchased by the government of China. They're purchased by Chinese companies. Some owned partially by the government. Others have no connection with the government, but they're purchased by people. When I've done motivational speaking and sales training, there are three absolutes, and I'm a person without many absolutes in my life. And those three absolutes are people make decisions, and the most important thing to people is themselves and their family. That people make decisions for their reasons, not for my reasons. And that every decision is based on emotion and justified with fact. And so we worked hard to create the market for our pork in Mexico and our pork in China, frankly. We worked very hard to create the market for soybeans in China. We worked very hard to create markets in Canada and Mexico, who combined are our two biggest agricultural trading partners. And then the President of the United States comes in and throws in tariffs. And all of a sudden, our products become more expensive to the consumers, not because of our tariff, but because their governments also impose tariffs. The other thing we have to consider is a tariff is not a tax on the producer. It's a tax on the consumer. It's not a tax on the exporter. It's a tax on the importer.
We're going to hold the tariff talk for there, and we will continue that in part two of this M2M podcast. My thanks to Steve Noah of Des Moines, Iowa, for his conversation, and we will pick it up in the next installment of the M2M podcast. I'm Paul Yeager. Thank you so very much for listening.